familiar with the Vancouver Institute, let me welcome you and invite you, you aren't obliged to, but invite you to buy a membership, which is very, very inexpensive, $10 for students, $20 for singles, $30 for whole families. You can bring your whole family here every Saturday night throughout the winter and spring sessions for your $30. It's a bargain. But you're not obliged to, and on the other hand, you're also not obliged to give donations, but we welcome them because that makes it possible for us to carry on this remarkable event throughout the Saturday nights of the winter and spring sessions at the university. Tonight we have the UBC Excellence in Research Lecture given by William Rees. Dr. Rees received his PhD at the University of Toronto in population ecology. He has taught at the University of British Columbia since 1969, and he is the founder of the Environment and Resource Planning Concentration and a former director at the School of Community and Regional Planning. Bill Rees, as he is known to his students and colleagues, is best known for inventing the ecological footprint analysis. This analysis, first published in 1996 as Our Ecological Footprint, has been translated into many other languages, and he has been invited to speak at many, many universities throughout the world. He is a co-investigator in the Global Integrity Project, aimed at defining the ecological and political requirements for biodiversity preservation. In 1997, UBC awarded Dr. Rees a Senior Killam Research Prize in acknowledgement of his research achievements. And tonight, he is going to give the lecture in research excellence. And we're very happy to invite Dr. Rees to come to the podium and give us a very special lecture this evening.
Well, thank you very much, Pat. It's a rare honor to have been asked to give this lecture. In fact, I was thrilled at the concept of doing it, at the thought of being able to come here this evening. I thought we might have about 35 or 40 other people interested in this kind of topic. So I'm doubly thrilled and honored to see so many people out here this evening. You do me great honor to show up. I know there's many competing options on a beautiful Saturday night like this. So thank you so much for being here. And to celebrate with us the Research Awareness Week here at UBC. I think universities in some ways have lost a little bit of ground in the past couple of decades in terms of showing leadership around where society ought to be going, given the trying times we're moving through. I think this, however, and other activities that the office and SIDCATS and others associated with it are doing is beginning to get us back on track and in seizing some of the intellectual leadership that we seem, I think, a little bit to have abandoned. Now, some of you who have very good eyesight will have already seen the evil eye in my first slide. There is an error. And I am a lover of Oriental carpets. And I've long been aware that the weavers of these carpets always incorporate one mistake somewhere in it, which guarantees that the rest will be successful. So I've incorporated an error in this first slide. And I assure you, everything else is truthful, and you can believe just about every word I've got to say here on in. Thank you very much. Before I get into the main body of the talk, and because I'm long-winded and go off on numerous tangents, I'd like to take you through the main points. Brenda, are you here? She advised me this might be a good idea. Thank you very much. So here's what I'd like to draw to your attention tonight. First of all, human beings, for all that we are a supposed evidence of intelligent life on Earth, really fail to understand who we are. We have a very limited understanding of what motivates us, why it is we do certain things that we do.
Human beings rarely like to think of themselves as biological entities. It comes to mind from time to time if you have heart palpitations or some other illness. But on the whole, we don't like to think of ourselves as biological entities. But indeed we are. We are products of evolution. And our behavior, both as individuals and as society, represents a delicate dialectic between a self-conscious reasoning and much deeper and sometimes darker unconscious predispositions. We've got a long evolutionary history, and many of the traits that we've acquired along the way, which were adaptive 50,000 years ago, are with us still, but now play havoc with our capacity to see far into the future. In other words, some of our most prominent qualities as human beings may well now be maladaptive. Techno-industrial society, in that regard, is inherently unsustainable. Now, that's going to be the mainstream of what I'm talking about tonight. I'm going to try to make that case based on the previous propositions. Basically, it's an argument that says that for many reasons that many of you will be already aware of, the world is ecologically full. But evolution has not provided us with any inhibitions against destroying our habitats, against extinguishing other species, or indeed against destroying other human groups. In this particular circumstance, then, prospects for building civil society, for retaining the prospects of civilized existence on the planet, depend mainly on our capacity to devise mutually beneficial cultural constraints on maladaptive social behavior. That's a mouthful to say that we have one last chance, and I don't think I'm overstating this, to step one more great step forward in our own evolution to the point where cultural factors hold sway over the darker colors in our biologically determined behavioral spectrum. And the last point I'd like to make this evening is that time may well be short. Any questions? Let's go on. Well, if we're going to fix ourselves, we need to know more about ourselves. And I think there's been a theme through literature that indeed we are not that familiar with our own nature. Man will become better only when you make him see what he is like, from the seagull. We are lived by forces we can scarcely understand. I love that quote. My premise is that humans are the product of evolution. We are the products of natural selection. But that uniquely, human evolution is now more determined by sociocultural factors than by biological factors. Now, both cultural and biological mutations are subject to natural selection. Everybody, I presume by now, realizes that maladaptive physical mutations will be selected out by an environment that simply finds them unsuitable. I'm trying to use simple language here, which is very difficult for me. I don't have any simple vocabulary. But just like biological mutations can be selected out, so it is that culturally, widespread cultural patterns can also be selected out by the environment. So both of these qualities of humankind are subject to natural selection. And the corollary is that maladaptive cultural traits, like disadvantageous physical mutations, then can be selected out. Now, there's a long history in support of this particular argument. And one of the most recent cases, which has been around in the popular press from time to time, so I thought I'd raise to your attention because some of you may be familiar with it anyway, is the story of Easter Island. Easter Island is a not unique by any means, but certainly well understood now story. It's a small rock about 135 square kilometers, about 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers from any other significant landmass. It was a verdant subtropical island, heavily forested, with at least two very important tree species and many useful plant and animal species from a human perspective. It was discovered, if you like, by human beings only around the year 450 or 500, so within the last two millennia. Probably no more than two or three canoe loads of Polynesian explorers, sailors, whatever, landed on this island and blossomed over the next 10 centuries into a little microcosm of a great culture. Over that period of time, they developed art and science, religion, agriculture, division of labor. They had some of this, obviously, when they had arrived there, but it blossomed into a unique culture with some of the finest stonework, both fitted stones for buildings and platforms and carvings known to prehistory. So it was indeed a little culture with all the manifestations and characteristics of some of the grander cultures that you would be aware of. The population rose to something like 10,000 people by the year 1500. But in 1500, something rather unique or unusual, well, perhaps those aren't the right words, but odd, let's say odd, happened. Easter Islanders cut down the last tree. This was a culture entirely dependent on their forest for the building of their dugout canoes, which was the means by which they obtained most of their animal protein. They ate fish and porpoises in the main. It was a small enough island that you could know just about everyone else. You could walk around it in 2 days. So presumably, everyone on the island was aware of the crisis that was upon them. There must have been great political debates to the extent that they had political debates in those days. And yet, for whatever reason, there was no effort toward conservation in the end. The last tree was felled. When Europeans discovered Easter Island just 200 years later, the population had fallen to a mere 2,000, perhaps a little less than that. Many of the great stone carvings had been pulled over. People were living in reed huts and crude caves. The houses had been destroyed. And the surviving remnants of only of a culture that had existed just 200 years before and now survived by making cannibalistic raids on each other's encampment. So as we examine the midden heaps of Easter Island, we can see over the 15 centuries of the history of the island, not 15, a thousand years, so 10 centuries of the island's history, the disappearance, one after another, of valuable food species until around 1500, the fish bones and porpoise bones were replaced by human bones. In the swamps in the interior of the island, paleobotanists have taken out cores and examined the pollen going back through the whole period of the history of colonization of Easter Island. And again, one by one, the important resource species disappear, and around 1500, the last pollen of the critical palm tree disappeared. So what is going on if virtually every member of a society is fully aware of their dependence, their isolation, on dependence on resources, isolation from any other sources, and yet they proceed to essentially destroy their own future? You can see these quotes are just from some of the many papers that have been written about it. Jared Diamond's 1995 paper ends with this single sentence: "Are we about to follow their lead?" Because obviously we're all aware we have an ecological crisis, we have a population problem, we have continuing evidence of growing geopolitical strife, and yet we seem, as another author, Clive Ponting, said, we seem unable to devise a system that will allow us to find the right balance with our environment. Well, is ignominious collapse the norm for complex societies? And it seems not. So that if we look in our literature, one of the most interesting books I've read in the last little while, although there are several on this theme, is by Joseph Tainter, The Collapse of Complex Societies. Actually, I see another error here, so I lied to you earlier. The quote is from a paper he wrote in 1995 called The Sustainability of Complex Societies. His book from 1984 was The Collapse of Complex Societies. Easter Island is no exception. What is perhaps most intriguing in the evolution of human beings is the regularity with which the pattern of increasing complexity is interrupted by collapse. So what Tainter did in his book was examine the fates of some 24 other very advanced cultures and saw them all go through a rather similar sequence. Well, we're not a primitive culture, at least that's one of our most popular cultural myths. We are a science-based culture. We are predisposed to respond to data, to analysis, not to myth, and so on. But what's the modern record? In a very controversial paper published in Science in the early 90s by some colleagues here at UBC, looking at the historical record, that is to say, the recent record of human exploitation of natural resources, they concluded their paper this way. Although there is a considerable variation in detail, there is remarkable consistency in the history of resource exploitation. Resources are invariably or inevitably overexploited, often to the point of collapse or extinction. Now, I walked in here this evening and picked up the latest copy of UBC Reports, and one of my colleagues, Daniel Pauly, is featured on the cover with his story on the current state of the world's fisheries. Ludwig, Hilborn, and Walters all work in the fisheries area as well. Something like 75% of the world's fish stocks are in a state of overexploitation due to human abuse as we speak. Dan Pauly is famous for pointing out that although the FAO measured fish catches each year remain relatively constant, it's not because we're managing well, but rather because we eliminate one species and one stock and simply move on to another. So we're literally fishing down the food chain, sweeping up the ocean's bounty as we go. This week in the Globe and Mail, there was a wonderful, well, wonderful in the scientific sense, little article on orchids. So we're going from something that we all think of as critical to survival to something that may be trivial. But here we see the disappearance of orchids as a foodstuff. In some African countries, orchid tubers are a favored food. And now that globalization has opened up markets around the world for these orchid tubers, as soon as a species of organism that exists in exquisite rarity, such as many of these orchids, becomes exposed to an ever-expanding global marketplace, there's always going to be someone willing to pay top dollar for the last remaining species or specimen of a species. And so we see great trade emerging in orchid tubers and apparent risking of these. Again, no inhibition against the extinction of these species. So it seems to me there's evidence enough in our historical record at least to hypothesize that Homo sapiens is inherently biased against sustainability. And in particular, I would argue that given our cultural circumstances and the nature of industrial society, that unsustainability is an inevitable emergent property. By that I mean it doesn't matter how you reconfigure the system at the margins, it's not going to make any difference. Industrial society is founded on certain principles that make it inherently unsustainable. And as I say, there are deep roots. A predisposition is encoded in our human biology and behavioral ecology, and this predisposition is currently being reinforced by cultural factors. Now, the proximate cause, I would argue, is that all species have an inherent capacity to expand into all of the ecological space available to them. And unless there are constraints on that expansion, a normal, what we would call negative feedback of one kind or another, they will do so to the point that they destroy some fundamental resource base leading to collapse. So that I've reproduced here just a couple of rather famous examples of, in this case, reindeer being introduced to islands which had previously not had reindeer populations. These islands are free of any disease vectors or predators on the reindeer. And we see in each case, although with rather different profiles, the rise of the population to a peak followed by a collapse. And if we extended this graph out a little bit so that the x-axis was 1,000 years or so, this would be exactly the profile of Easter Island. So that the rise and fall of deer populations is no different from the rise and fall of human populations on Easter Island. Similar circumstances, verdant environment, no natural checks on population growth, no cultural checks on population growth, overwhelm that habitat, destroy the foodstuffs, population, it collapses. So human beings are as much caught up in the fundamentals of ecological reality as are any other species that don't enjoy the trappings of our culture. Now, I've tried to put this in a particular framework that makes a great deal of sense to me. I'm not sure that everyone would agree with this, but I think the bioevolutionary factor was recognized a long time ago, certainly in the early part of the last century, and first brought to, I suppose, light by Boltzmann, who was actually a physicist, one of the fathers of thermodynamic theory, familiar with Darwinian natural selection. He recognized that energy is the key. And in fact, he said the struggle for existence or the struggle for life is really a struggle for free energy available to do work. What species in ecosystems are doing is competing and cooperating, in a quoted sense, with each other in order to maximize their appropriations of energy and associated material resources with which they then survive and reproduce. So that successful species, successful ecosystems, are those that maximize their appropriations of energy from their environment and then secondarily maximize the efficiency with which they convert that into new individuals of their own species, and in the human case, the trappings of our culture, the satisfaction of our industrial as well as our biological metabolism. Now, there's a corollary here that we tend to forget in our increasingly competitive global environment, and that is that the dynamics of unfettered competition among individuals, corporations, and economies in an unregulated finite environment will preclude any constraint or restraint on human behavior or on conservation. And we call that the open access problem. That's just a bit of an aside. Now, I've said in my title that human beings may be fatally successful. So if you accept that we're engaged in a competitive struggle for energy, it's not hard to derive from the literature a very lengthy list of those things about human beings that give us a leg up. And I've tried to boil these down to four that make particular sense to me. The first is, and don't forget, our first source of energy is bioenergy, the basic stuff we need for food. And a well-fed population in an open environment will reproduce and fill that niche. The point about humans is that we have a uniquely broad or Catholic food capacity. We can eat just about anything. We're omnivorous, and this enables us to tap into more sources of bioenergy than virtually any other large mammal of comparable size to ourselves. Moreover, if we cannot eat something, we'll domesticate an animal that can, and then we will eat the animal or its byproducts. Which takes us to the second point, in a sense. Humans are uniquely adaptive, which enables us to exploit virtually all ecosystems and environments on the planet. We can live in the desert. We may not be able to eat desert plants, but goats will, so we'll take the goats with us. There is no habitat type on planet Earth now that is not occupied to some degree by human beings. So we have access, because of our incredible adaptability, to virtually any habitat type on the planet. We exploit all the major ecosystems, and we are therefore able to tap into the multiple food sources, even in pre-industrial and pre-agricultural times, far beyond the capacities of any other species. It's interesting in these times, when many people who are caught up in our technological thinking and our economic thinking, we see us as becoming increasingly independent of the environment. But if you look at it from this perspective, it becomes perfectly clear what the answer to the following question is. What is the most ecologically significant marine mammal? I've given you, Well, plankton's not, it's amazing. I've asked this question 5 times in the last couple of months, and plankton comes up every time. Plankton is ecologically significant, but there's a little bit of taxonomic confusion, not a mammal, okay, good. So. What is mammal now? These are hairy, warm-blooded beasts. Sorry? Ah. I'm hearing all sorts of things up there. I can't quite tell what they are, but I heard the correct answer down here, and the answer is they're sitting in your seats. So what do I mean by ecologically significant? What I'm talking about here is, what is that mammal which appropriates, as a consumer organism, the largest proportion of the biomass generated by the photosynthetic processes in the world's oceans? Now, we don't tend to think of ourselves as marine mammals, but in ecological terms, because of our technology, we are. We are by far the most ecologically significant marine mammal. And if you're still disturbed by that designation, what's a marine bird? It's a bird that lives on land and goes fishing. People live on land and go fishing. And the human fish catch now is larger than the catch of protein taken by all the marine mammals that live in the sea. Now, we could make the same argument about terrestrial habitats. We are by far the most ecologically significant grazing mammal on the plains and grasslands of the world. We are by far the major exploiter of the productivity of the world's forests. So because of our unique qualities as organism at exploiting multiple environments, at tapping into all of the available sources of energy and matter, no other species comes close to dominating the planet and its eco-processes as human beings. More important than either of those is our acquisition of language. The great leap forward was with the acquisition of language, because it made possible my fourth point, the fact that human knowledge is cumulative. Not only do we have unique capacities to exploit our environments, but because of our ability to communicate, we get better and better at doing it. Each new technological advance is simply used by others to make the next great technological advance. So that, in fact, the main impact of technology in our era is not to disconnect humankind from the ecosphere, but rather to extend both the scope and the intensity with which we exploit the ecosystems of which we are now the dominant consumer organism. I want to point out, just in that kind of statement, one of the great, I suppose, disconnects in our intellectual sphere, and that is our continued thinking, because of urbanization, because of the advance of technology, that we are increasingly independent of the rest of nature. The reality is, technology has made us more a component of nature than we have ever been. Now, I've emphasized energy here, and I want to illustrate the importance of this by pointing out two great leaps forward in human dominance of the planet. One was associated with the forced adoption of agriculture. It's not something apparently that humans invented and then it rapidly spread because it was such a great idea. People were actually reluctant to do it. There's a big story here. Come back next year and I'll tell you that. But the main point is, if you looked at the average rate of human population growth as best as we can determine it for about 10,000 years prior to agriculture, when agriculture was adopted over a 1,000 or 2,000 year period, the following 10,000 years of population growth was about 13-fold more rapid than the previous period of 10,000 years. So having been able to move from simple hunting-gathering, which had major effects on ecosystems but didn't destroy them, humans began to modify entire landscapes to redirect the bioenergy flows of photosynthesis to a single species, ourselves, with the result a 13-fold increase in the average population growth rate for about 10,000 years. The second great leap forward in energy happened only a century and a half ago with the widespread use of fossil fuels. So fossil fuels are the major physical factor behind the fourfold increase in human populations in just 150 years and the 40-fold increase in human economic activity. So if we look at the curve of population growth for human beings over the last two millennia, you can see that the massive, by far the majority, the fourfold increase from about 1.5 million in 1850 to the present population of over 6 billion. This curve stops a couple of years short of the current population. We're about 6.2 billion people now, a full fourfold above the population attained just 150 years ago. Well, notice in this curve, the relationship to fossil energy. What we see here from about 1850 to the present time is the displacement of human and animal labor by fossil energy. And what it shows is that we are now utterly dependent for most of the work done in our society on a single source of energy. So that the average person today has working for him or her in an advanced industrial wealthy culture such as ours, something like 100 to 200 energy slaves, depending on which country you take. Each of us is the equivalent of 100 to 200 pre-agricultural or rather pre-industrial human beings in terms of our appropriations of the world's output due to being able to tap into an abundant, cheap source of fossil energy. The way we use energy is to increase our rate of exploitation of everything else. We could not have fished down the seas. We could not have deforested the planet without, at least certainly not at the rate we have done, without the subsidy from fossil fuels. So it can truly be said that no resources change the structure of our economies, the nature of technology, or the balance of geopolitics than energy. It really is the major resource. Now, getting to the sustainability end of this argument, there are enormous costs to our success. So when we expand, keeping in mind that the main source of energy and resources is derived from the ecosystems in which we are now the major components, and the extent to which human beings appropriate energy and material flows from these ecosystems, we deplete those systems of the flows required to sustain other species. And there are three main mechanisms by which we do this. The first is simply to displace other species from the ecological niches they once occupied. So another question I've asked our high school kids a couple of times, and even grade school students when I go out into the schools, is this one. Where are the bison that once occupied the Great Plains of North America? Well, they're sitting in your seats too. So that the 60 million bison that used to migrate regularly through that great wondrous grasslands, we've destroyed the native prairie and replanted it to wheat, oats, barley, and rye, which we consume, or we feed to cattle. In fact, half of our grain goes to feeding cattle. And when you add up the energy flows and make an adjustment for the increased production due to artificial fertilizers, the biomass of human beings and their animals sustained by the grasslands of North America is essentially the energetic equivalent of the numerous species that used to exist there before we displaced them from their ecological niches. Well, we don't like competition either. So right now in British Columbia, we're debating whether we ought to open up the cull of wolves. Well, why would we be interested in shooting wolves? Well, because they eat our caribou and moose and reindeer. We don't recognize that we're the main predators on the caribou, moose, and reindeer. And if you want to bolster those populations, you might cut back on hunting. But no, we'd rather eliminate competitors. And so let's have more wolf kill. We legalize shooting of seals who would prey on our fish farms, for example. So last year, if you read the papers, you will have known that there was a bit of a scandal over one of the fish farms that had a pile of 17 large sea lions outside its gates, perfectly legal. They threatened the economics of the fish farms. We're also a unique species in that we're the only one that poisons its own food supply with the massive applications of pesticides to eliminate insects who would compete with us for our own food. And the third way in which we aggrandize our own enterprise is by depleting both self-producing or renewable assets. I've already talked about the shrinkage of our fish stocks, but we could talk about deforestation, the drawing down of water tables, the erosion and other degradation of soils around the planet. This is a thermodynamic process by which we are converting the productivity and the biomass of the rest of the ecosystems into human biomass and the infrastructure of our industrial economy. So we're eliminating other species, populations, forest, groundwater, hydrocarbons, and so on, as a natural and unavoidable consequence of being an integral component of a finite system which isn't growing. So if you have one species out of anywhere between 10 or 30 million, we don't know how many species there are on the planet, but we're growing not only in our own population, but because of our use of an artificial energy subsidy, each of us is effectively growing to be 200 times, as much as 200 times the size of a single individual. And so the consequences are fairly obvious. But it's an ancient legacy. Again, I'm trying to maintain this energy theme. We can now examine the record of human beings spreading out over the planet from Africa through Europe and Asia, ultimately Australasia, North America, South America. And in every area where we now are beginning to put together the picture of this human spreading and dominance of the planet, way beyond, obviously, agricultural times in the last 50,000 years, we see that the record is one of mass extinctions of large flightless birds, relatively slow-moving, easily hunted mammals, and so on. And I've given you a couple of examples, Madagascar and New Zealand, both isolated islands that had no previous exposure to predatory species, while huge quantities of organisms were wiped out when human beings first arrived there. There's many, many good books that can give you a complete picture of this. So what I'm saying is that even in pre-industrial, pre-agricultural times, the qualities of human beings as very large, warm-blooded, energy-demanding animals that are social animals that live in large groups with exceptional hunting and gathering skills, every ecosystem into which even primitive man inserted himself, there was a massive shift in the relative balance of biomass and in the nature of the energy and material flows through those systems, resulting in the extinction of many species, although in some cases the exhaustion of others. We call this, when we look at it between other species, the competitive exclusion principle. And I'm just putting it in the context of human beings out-competing others. When there's only a finite supply of anything, the competitive exclusion principle can operate if one of the competing entities is vastly superior to the others. So that bioenergy appropriated from the global total for humans is irreversibly unavailable to competing species. What we get, they don't. And as a result of human appropriations of energy, by taking over habitats and converting them to producing for us, the current rate of species extension, the estimates vary from 100 to 10,000 times, but seems to be around 1,000 times more rapid than the rate of extinction experienced prior to the advent of industrial man. Now, the point is then that if there is no change, now this is a really a key argument that we tend to forget in this great search we're now engaged in for alternative energy supplies. If you're interested in non-human life on this planet, the greatest disaster that could befall the planet is for humans to tap into yet another abundant, cheap source of energy. Because if there's no change in our values and our behavior, in other words, no change in the ways in which we apply energy to the exploitation of the ecosystems of which we are a part, then we will continue doing what we're doing now on an even grander scale. And I think that would be disastrous for the non-human world, whatever good it might be due to humans. Okay, so I've made the case, or at least I hope I've convinced some of you, that there is an inherent tendency in human beings, or at least a propensity to overexploit their habitats, that this was latent in our basic biology, but with the acquisition of culture and the cumulative effects of technology. We've simply got better and better and better at doing this. I've made the point in passing that there's no inhibition built in to our destroying our habitats. And if you think about it, it's hard to imagine how it might have evolved. Because in pre-big brain times, humans could not significantly damage their habitats, and no selection occurred that would inhibit them from doing so. The very rapid acquisition of culture in the last 50,000 years with the evolution of our larger brains, therefore, has enabled us to sweep forward uninhibited by any previous record. Now, the second point I want to make that is driving us forward has to do with the nature of our perception. And we have to start by understanding that the brain is an illusion organ. In fact, that's the title of a chapter in a wonderful book by Philip Riegel called The Anatomy of Judgment. How many of you can see me up here? See? It's all an illusion. Let me tell you what I mean by this. First of all, you don't see me. You see light reflected off of me, light that is therefore not me, right? Stupid argument, but there it is. You don't even see that light. You see an image on the back of your eye, but it's been distorted by moving through the air, which is full of suspended particles, and it gets warped by moving through your aqueous and vitreous humors and the lens of your eye and so on. So that distorts it a little more. And by the way, the image on the back of your eye, which some of you are now realizing that's what we really see, is inverted. Now, how many of you see me upside down? Okay. So again, you don't see the image on the back of your eye, retina, because on the retina, the light interacts with chemicals which are converted at the rod and cone cells into electrical stimuli, which then travel along a living wire to a portion of the brain where the image is assembled by a mechanism we haven't the faintest idea about. So even though we are a visual animal, in other words, our sight is our most important sense, and we construct what we perceive to be reality out of our direct contact with it, in fact, what you construct is a multiply perverted and changed and distorted imagery that the brain puts together for its own convenience. How many of you would call that a solid object? It's only a solid object because we perceive it so. Okay. In fact, there's vastly more space here than there is solid stuff, but as a matter of evolutionary convenience, because I interact with it as if it were solid, that's the way I perceive it. Now, the main point I'm trying to get at here, and Riegel does it in many, many, many pages with brilliant illustrations, is that all of our perception is a construct. First of all, it's a biophysical construct, and then if you can accept that, that you don't see me, but rather a reconstruction that your brain does by some miraculous process, it shouldn't be so great a leap to realize that most of what we believe as a culture, the fundamental underpinnings of our culture, is also constructed from joint perceptions. So I'm going to make a great leap forward and argue that myth-making, the construction of social belief systems, which I'm going to call myth-making, is a universal property of human societies. Pardon me. And plays a vital role in every culture, including our own. Now, when I say myth, most of you will probably think of something that is incorrect, something that is a superstitious belief, something that we should cast aside as being the kind of belief system of relatively primitive people who don't have our advantage of being science-based, factually based. We've abandoned our need for mythic constructs. That is our greatest social myth. So what I'm getting at here is that human belief that we are primarily now oriented to acting based on knowledge gained through science is simply incorrect in just about every dimension. In fact, I've just read a marvelous paper. If anyone wants to share it with me, I'll read it with you after the talk. An extensive study of the degree to which environmental knowledge changes people's behavior. And it doesn't. So it's just one illustration of the many, many areas in which we find that the best of scientific knowledge has almost no impact on how people behave or on the political process. Now, I'm going to draw that out a little bit later, but the main point I want to get at right now is that we are, like every culture that has ever preceded us, embedded in our own myths, so much so that we don't recognize them as myths. Now, there's a wonderful little book by Colin Grant, a theologian at one of the Eastern, Mount Allison University, I believe, called Myths We Live By. And he starts with much the same premise, that we delude ourselves. It's one of our myths that we're not mythic. And his whole book is based on expanding on this quote I've taken from the first chapter. Myths should be seen not as mistaken beliefs, but as comprehensive visions that give shape and direction to life. So that the capacity for myth-making, for social self-delusion, was a necessary quality of a very intelligent species, evolving in a mysterious environment which they couldn't possibly comprehend through science. So in order to make sense of their environment, in order to provide social cohesion, in order to give a story that would help them to, get on, we all did. Human beings created social myths, which then became an indispensable way of understanding people's place in nature. Myths then are essential categories that we all should take for granted. Having said that, there's a perverse side to our capacity for self-delusion. Another wonderful book in the last couple of years by Derek Jensen makes, in many, many pages, the following point. For us to maintain our way of living, we must tell lies to each other and especially to ourselves. These lies act as barriers to truth, and the barriers are necessary because without them, many deplorable acts would become impossibilities. So one of the ways in which human cultures use myth is to enable them to perpetrate absolute atrocities on other groups of people. If you think of the Holocaust, for example, one could argue that the German culture in the middle part of the last century, and for that matter, the 19th century, was one of the best educated, most literate of all human societies at the time. And yet, their education, in fact, some would say because of their particular kind of education, nothing in it inured them to perpetrating the Holocaust, one of the greatest catastrophes to befall human beings in the last century. I would argue that in the last several months, we have seen on many sides the greatest flurry of attempted conscious myth-making in the history of our species around the post-9/11 activities. If any of you believe anything that you've read in the papers about this as truth, I think you probably ought to re-examine it in this kind of framework. We are engaged as a culture in the most blatant example of myth-making that you could possibly imagine. And one way of getting a very good sense of this is to look at how differently the myths are playing out, say, in the United States versus Europe. And anyone who has facility on the internet will recognize that it's not even a description of the same world. And yet we see the same powers of myth-making coming forward to create a sense of tribal unity to enable a particular set of deplorable circumstances to unfold with a sufficient degree of public support. Now, fortunately, it's beginning to come apart, and that's where I want to take this conversation as we move forward. The main point, though, is that we are, for whatever else we might think of ourselves, wholly susceptible to myth. One that I suppose is at the heart of my main argument, and that is to say that our economic myth of sustained economic growth is almost the broadest and most widely held cultural myth, and perhaps it is, ever in human history. Because in the last 25 years in particular, all international agencies and national governments have come to share a comprehensive vision of global development centered on unlimited economic expansion fueled by more liberalized trade. Now, at the heart of this vision is a singular belief that has now been raised to primacy as a principal focus of all social policy practically. And that is that human welfare, human well-being, can be all but equated with a single variable, that is to say, an increasing propensity to consume, rising per capita income. And we are sacrificing an inordinate array of other values in order to sustain the belief that this is the only one that really counts. And again, to go to Colin Grant's interpretation of myth, this contemporary myth has been the principal force giving shape and direction to political and civil life in both high-income and developing countries on every continent for at least the past 25 to 30 years. Now, first of all, it's not even good economics. So it's quite amazing to me that economists aren't up in arms about this, because the fact of the matter is that it's being perpetrated as the quintessential example of market economics. But a good economist, if you get him at the bar with a beer or two, will admit that this extreme neoliberal thinking is a perversion of economics, because good economic theory recognizes that we ought to be striving to maximize human well-being or human welfare, but that there are multiple variables that contribute to that. So that if you believe in safe communities, a good public education and healthcare system, in safe cities, and so on and so forth, and you are willing to pay taxes to get those things, or even forego the next increment of income in order to benefit from those other variables, and you indeed feel better off for having done so, your welfare will have increased despite your even reduction in propensity to consume. And I think the argument can now be made that globally, the marginal ecological and social costs, that is to say, with each increment of growth, which we do add up and count as gross world product, we are doing more damage which goes unmonitored because of our incapacity appropriately to measure it or disinterest in doing so. We have no inclination to do so in many instances. It may well be that globally, growth is now causing more damage at the margin than it's providing in benefits. Unfortunately, the benefits go to one place, the damages go to another, and because of this distributional inequity, which cannot even be accounted for in the mainstream economic models, again, a major accounting error goes unnoticed, and we perpetuate the growth myth because it benefits some of us who happen to be those perpetuating the growth myth. I hope you've noticed that little aspect of it. But if that scenario is true, we're actually guilty of promoting uneconomic growth, growth that impoverishes. Herman Daly, an ecological economist, has been making much light of that. Well, it's bad economics in quite another way, because what we have learned with great many repeated examples of this in countries around the world is that once a certain level of income is achieved, and it's about $7,500 or $8,000 international dollars per capita per year, there's no correlation between well-being and income growth. So we're struggling to maintain this constant upward pressure on the propensity to consume for no benefit whatsoever. In many rich countries today, we can identify no objective nor subjective improvement in well-being as GDP increases. Here is one study, another very recent book by Robert Lane called The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies. And he is talking in this particular chapter about the United States. It's a rather poor chart because the $6,000 seems to be labeling the end of a line there. It doesn't. It's just the income at which the 7.2... Oh, I have a pointer here, don't I? So that $6,000 really relates to the index over here. It's not the end of that line. The point is that over this period of some 50 years, as rising per capita income occurred in the United States, a steady increase in per capita income, there's been an equally steady decline in the average numbers of people reporting themselves as happy or very happy in a standardized survey that's been taken consistently over that entire period. The United States, people, is not a very happy place. But it's not unique on the planet among market democracies. So we see a complete disconnect here between the fundamentals in the economic growth model. It's bad economics to begin with, and it's not achieving its own stated goals. Now, what intelligent species would continue to propagate such a model around the planet? Is there intelligent life on Earth? Now, to be fair to economists, there's a revolt occurring within the discipline. It's becoming quite vocal. It's wonderful to behold. One of the more articulate proponents of this revolt is J.K. Galbraith. It's not John, it's James Kenneth Galbraith, the son of. And in a wonderful paper just a couple of years ago, in commenting, he wrote this paper on the agenda and the papers presented at the annual meeting of the American Economics Association, the largest association of economists on the planet. And his conclusion was that self-absorption and consistent policy error are just two of the endemic problems. The deeper problem is the nearly complete collapse of prevailing economic theory, so complete, so pervasive, that the profession can only deny it by refusing to discuss theoretical questions. This is not a mild statement of his discontent with the situation, but it is a mild statement relative to many others that I could have brought forward. I've tried to bring forward a fairly moderate. So there is a great debate going on here about the degree to which modern neoliberal, and particularly in places where it's become so abstracted in terms of its theoretical mathematical model building for anything in the real world, that it has reduced itself as essentially to irrelevance. Now again, in terms of our particular exercise, we have to recognize that most of the mainstream economic models that we are now using to run the planet are structurally incompatible with any real-world system. Robert Ayers, a very well-known economist and a thermodynamicist, actually, argues that neoclassical models do not incorporate any information about actual ecosystem structure. It goes beyond that. Paul Christensen, by the way, these are all economists. So it's not just that some long-haired ecologist talking, shooting from the hip. These are some of the internal criticisms. Paul Christensen recognizes that the simple, reversible, mechanistic behavior of many economic models is inconsistent with the connectivity, irreversibility, positive feedback of complex energy information and ecosystem. By the way, it's also incompatible with those same qualities in real-world economic and social systems. So we are modeling using models that are inconsistent at the important levels with the behavior of the systems they are now controlling. The problem is, since we've bought into this myth, it's working at one very primitive level. The single variable that we focused on is indeed growing. So that the economy has tripled in size since 1980. I mentioned the 40-fold increase in the last 150 years, a 3-fold increase in the last 23 years or so. We anticipate an additional 5-fold expansion of gross world output in the next half century. Meanwhile, the population has increased by 30% since 1980 and is still growing at 80 million per year, and at least 3 to 4 additional billions can be expected by the middle of this century. So the human dynamic is operating. We're becoming ever more dominant and more certainly more dominant on the planet. Meanwhile, the ecosphere is doing, obviously, the kinds of things we read about every time we pick up the paper, if you're conscious at all of these things. So that we see that half the world's forests have been logged, half the land on Earth has been modified for human use, 70% of the fish stocks are in jeopardy, carbon dioxide levels are up by 30%, in the century, biodiversity loss is accelerating, and there's some specific numbers there on the rates of this biodiversity loss. So these are massive impacts by a species that considers itself detached from biophysical reality and independent of any consequences. See, once we've separated ourselves from the other, it doesn't matter what happens to the other. But if that is part of our myth, and the fact is we are embedded in the other, then what happens to the other becomes absolutely essential to our future survival. So again, are we too damn successful? And is our success in dominating the planet likely to do us in, unless we wake up to it, which is why you're all here tonight? Now, I invented a concept called ecological footprint analysis precisely to counter an economist's argument at this university that the concept of human carrying capacity was irrelevant. And so what I've attempted to do with this work is to develop an index of the percentage or proportion of the Earth's surface dedicated to supporting any defined human population. And I call that the human ecological footprint. It could be an individual, could be a city, country, or the whole human population. It's widely used now in studies of this kind, and most recently the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, which publishes a biannual report called the Living Planet Index, has picked it up. And these are their numbers, not mine, showing the increase of the human ecological footprint over the past 40 years or so, and they have now correlated that with the decline in their own index, the Living Planet Index. And I was both chagrined and delighted to find that they come to the same conclusion, that the steady increase in human appropriations from the ecosystems results in a steady decline in the Living Planet Index, an index of biodiversity and biomass in the ecosystems we share with other species. So just what is this all about? My main concern now, and to put this in the context of current affairs, is that we will soon begin to extend competitive exclusion to other human groups. So it's not any longer merely that people are displacing other species from the sustenance they need, but we are on the verge of, and indeed I think beginning to displace other humans, and this then creates a whole new moral and ethical crisis, it seems to me, in a planet of declining resources, increasing population, and certainly increasing geopolitical instability. Ted Gurr, a political scientist who studied the relationship between civil strife and resource scarcity, made this comment as far back as 1985. Much of this really good work now is being done by Canadians, but this guy, I think, was at the University of Montana. So long as ecological decline is temporary, advantaged groups, wealthy folks like us, are likely to accept policies of relief and redistribution as the price of order and the resumption of growth. But once we accept decline as a persistent condition, people will do almost anything to regain their economic and political power and thereby maintain their absolute and relative advantages. Now, that is a normal human response that goes right back to the maximum power principle. Human beings compete with each other for dominance. And this comes from our limbic system, the earlier parts of the human brain. The conscious thinking part is a kind of a layer on top of that. So I want you to start thinking now of the neocortex, the most recently acquired portion of the human brain. That's the thinking part, the imaginative part, the creative element, as being a kind of an overlay on this underlying, more primitive, some call it the reptilian brainstem as a major part of the limbic system, that contains all of the predispositions that we have, the inherent or innate behavioral qualities that begin to emerge in our politics. It's one of the reasons why the political system is so inured or incapable of responding to real data, because it's not a thinking system. It's a limbic system responding to the crudest behaviors of people, the need for people to acquire prestige and self-esteem within community, and for each community to feel itself dominant over other communities. So how does this tie to the ecological footprint? Again, to remind you of the definition, the eco footprint of any population, could be one individual, a whole country, is the area of land and water ecosystems required in continuous production to produce everything that population consumes and to assimilate all the wastes that the population produces. Now, just to give you a concrete way of thinking of this, what would happen to this city if it were enclosed in an impermeable glass bell jar? It'd get hot, yeah, it would. And so it would be a hot place to starve and suffocate at the same time. Right? Because the city is not, you know, we think in economic terms that the city is the engine of economic growth, the center of productivity and all of that. It is those things. But everything that happens in the city is sustained by productivity that occurs outside of the boundaries of the city. So that when you think of that bell jar, the next question might be, how large would it have to be before there would be a sufficient area contained within it to sustain the activities going on within it? And that's what I'm trying to measure through these ecological footprint studies. The size the bell jar has to be to support any given population at its current level, whatever that might be, of consumption. And when we do this for a variety of countries, we find that the average footprint of a resident of a high-income country varies between roughly 4 and, say, 10 hectares per capita. If you still think in acres, that's between 10 and 22 acres or thereabouts. And this means that many high-income, densely populated countries today, in ecological terms, occupy more land outside their own boundaries than is contained within them. You know, it's a great irony that I was at a meeting in Europe not so long ago where an economist pointed out the miracle of Dutch agriculture insofar as Holland is the world's, or at least Europe's most densely populated country, 435 people per square kilometer, and yet has an agricultural surplus. Well, that's only true if you measure what economists measure, which is dollar flow, so that the value of Dutch agriculture, agricultural exports, exceeds the value of Dutch imports. But what the Dutch import is fodder. And the fodder the Dutch import is grown on an area of land 3 to 5 times larger than the entire land base of the country. They convert that fodder into high value added cheeses, meats, and processed agricultural goods for export. So it's true they have an economic surplus in dollar terms, but it's sustained by a massive ecological deficit. In other words, the ecological footprint of Dutch agriculture occurs largely outside the country in those places from which it imports water to grow its food. And when you look at the rest of the Dutch economy, Holland happens to occupy an area of land several times larger than the entire country all over the planet. So in ecological terms, the Dutch don't live in Holland any more than we live in Vancouver. It's just where we keep our bodies, the productive landscape is someplace else. I once wrote a short article for the Vancouver Sun that landed me in no end of grief because I called it "The City as Human Feedlot." And if you think of if you think of a cattle feedlot or an agricultural feedlot, it's a crowded place with huge waste management problems. But the land that supports that population is someplace else. We just bring the grain in, and that's what a city is. In strictly ecological terms. By the way, this is not an anti-urban rant. I have also written, what did I write? Oh, yes. Our great cities are among the brightest stars in the constellation of human achievement. So any urbanists can take that and balance it off against the feedlot comment. Well, let's look at a transnational progression of ecological footprints here, just to give you an idea of the extent to which this analysis shows up the growing inequity in the world's countries. So here we have Canada, pardon me, the United States, Australia, and so on the left with very large footprints. The sort of flat area is most of the what we would think of as the advanced countries of Europe and Asia. Footprints on the order of 4.5 hectares, much more efficient than we are in energy use in particular. Then we have that step up, the so-called emerging economies of Eastern Europe and Asia. And then down here at the far end, the developing world. Is there anything happening here? Can anybody see that? Okay. These economies over here, Ethiopia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Mozambique, with eco-footprints perhaps as little as a 20th of the size of the Canadian and U.S. footprints in some instances. These, of course, are the poorest of the poor, but half or more of the world's population exists in those countries. Now, the important, well, of many, over here we have the average world eco-footprint. Right now, the average human being requires about 2 hectares of productive land to produce all the stuff they consume and to assimilate their wastes. The difficulty is that there's only about 1.9 hectares or less per capita on the planet. so that we've actually exceeded the long-term global carrying capacity by about 20% when all is said and done here. So if you multiply the human population of 6.2 billion by the average human footprint, we come up with the estimated global ecological footprint on the right, but there's fewer than 12 billion hectares of productive ecosystem on Earth. We get, therefore, less than 2 hectares per capita. To sustain the average Canadian requires about 4 times our available, what I would call, fair share. So high-end consumers occupy up to 10 hectares each, but there are only 2 hectares per capita of productive land on the planet. This 2 hectares is our fair share. Where do we get the rest? Well, we get it by globalization. Okay. Globalization, in ecological terms, is the social device by which the wealthy and powerful of the planet extend their ecological footprints into the lands and territories of weaker, impoverished populations. And we can measure this directly through the trade flows into various countries. About 7 years ago, the Department of Environment in Britain commissioned the International Institute for Environment and Economy to do an ecological footprint of Britain. And they examined every significant trade flow and converted those into the amount of land in other countries dedicated to sustaining Britain's population. As soon as the study appeared, it was ordered to be removed from circulation because of the political implications of pointing out the extent to which Britain relied on the rest of the world for its inputs. In that particular study, London alone was shown to occupy the entire ecological territory of the United Kingdom. In other words, were Britain forced to rely on its own bioproductivity, assuming we could convert forest to agriculture in proportions needed, then London alone would take up the entire output of the UK, and the rest of the population, in effect, is therefore living on the inputs from other countries. Well, this parallels perfectly the economic outlay as well. I've mentioned already that income is the means by which we extend our footprints elsewhere. In 1970, the richest 10% of the world's citizens earned 19 times as much as the poorest 10%. After some quarter century of growth under the globalization paradigm, this emphasis on sheer income growth, this ratio had actually increased to 27 to 1. So we're seeing that the rich are getting rapidly more rich, and the poor are, in many cases, stagnating, and in the case of Africa, actually getting both absolutely and relatively worse off than they were before the growth mania occurred. By 1977, the wealthiest 1% of the world's people commanded the same income as the poorest 57%. 25 million rich Americans, that's 0.4% of the world's population, and less than 10% of the U.S. population, has a combined income greater than the poorest 2 billion people, or 43% of the world's population. Now again, appreciate those numbers in the context of two things we've raised tonight. The first is the prominence of energy in maintaining global dominance. All right? Now, the United States is the world's largest energy-consuming country. Less than 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's energy. The United States would fall flat on its face, cut off from foreign trade. Every strategic mineral is required to be imported into the United States. I believe that one of the reasons for the American interest in intellectual property rights is because of the dire need of the United States to be able to sell something into the world and use the revenues by which to maintain its command over so much of the world's resource base. The contemporary dilemma then, just to summarize, I'm finishing soon, I know you're all getting nervous, so am I. The world's ecologically full. In fact, it's full to overflowing. But so far, the distribution of the benefits of the growth that has got us there is grotesquely inequitably distributed. We cannot grow our way to sustainability, but must instead come to share the world's economic and ecological output. How we approach this problem will necessarily represent a dialectic between self-conscious reason and unconscious predisposition. We don't like sharing. But if we don't, we will have to face the consequences. So the real question for me is, are we capable of achieving global stability based on enlightened self-interest? Now, it's well known again from human behavioral studies that, as I said, we don't like to share. We're not inherently altruistic, except to kin or except to people with whom we develop a reciprocally altruistic relationship. So somehow, the job before us is to convince ourselves of an entirely new social myth that can be sustained both by our biology but needs to be created by our cultural adaptiveness. And this is a social myth in the sense that it's a grand belief that we all share. It doesn't mean it's untrue. But it's a myth that will require us all to recognize that it is in our mutual self-interest to move progressively toward negotiated settlement of the way in which the world's wealth will be shared rather than the way we seem to be approaching the problem in recent history, like this week, for example. And as often said, those who are who do not read their history are condemned to repeat it. At bottom, what I'm saying is even if you know your history, you're condemned to repeat it. If you don't rise above that primitive level of human behavior, the predispositional behavior that derives from our limbic system, and allow to come to dominance the dispositional behavior that comes from learning, from intellectual activity, from being able to reason these things through, and most importantly, that comes from self-awareness. Can we create the social and cultural institutional framework necessary to constrain the rogue that lies within? The problem is that if we look at our own history in the last century, the 20th century was the most devastating, destructive, deadly century in the history of human beings. And over we see statements like this in the analysis of it. The rise and fall of cultures has been primarily determined by the tides of passion, not by the ebb and flow of reason. We see ourselves as reasonable people. We see ourselves as science-based people. But the reality is, as this paper I'm happy to share with you later shows, we don't respond to knowledge when it interferes with our primitive expectations, with our passions. Only a small fraction of the population is consistently capable of applying the most basic rule of evidence to emotionally derived or emotionally loaded information. Lyndon Caldwell, a wonderful American political scientist who's been at the forefront of environment relationships in the United States, wrote way back in 1990, "The prospect for worldwide cooperation to forestall a disaster seems far less likely where deeply entrenched economic and political interests are involved. The cooperative task would require behavior that humans find most difficult, collective self-discipline in a common effort." And again, this is our great challenge. Can we afford to risk asserting our individual or national self-interest in an environment as tight as the one that we have on the planet today? Or do we risk the great challenge of rising to our true difference from other species? The one thing that makes us uniquely different is that capacity for higher reason. And if it does not come to dominate our individual behavior, our national behavior, and the behavior of nations in the international arena, then we have no hope but to fall back into the patterns that have plagued us through our history. We have the institutions in place. They aren't perfect. They're plagued by the same problems we've been talking about. I mean, within the United Nations, there's power dominance and competition among, you know, petty groups and all of that kind of stuff. Well, that's the reality we have to deal with at every level. But things like the International Criminal Court, which the United States has declined to participate in, are the kinds of mechanisms we need to hold in check the worst aspects of human behavior. Now, I hesitated to put this in, but I thought it would anyway. What the heck, you're all grown-up people. This is a statement from a relative dove within the United States State Department in 1948. He was describing U.S. foreign policy as he saw it, as it ought to be directed mainly toward Asia, but that's okay, we can extend this to other places. And to my mind, this is the most the best statement I have ever seen of maximum power politics and what I would call the restricted logic of the limbic system. What he says is, well, you can read it, we have 50% of the world's wealth. It's down to 33% now or thereabouts. And 6.3% of the population, it's really closer to 5% right now. So some things have changed in the last half century. Nevertheless, half the world's wealth and 6% of its population, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Does this resonate with anyone today? Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. Now, as I say, that is an absolutely perfect expression of territorial limbic response to resource scarcity and all the rest of it. He goes on, believe it or not. We should stop putting ourselves in the position of being our brother's keeper and refrain from offering moral and ideological advice. We should cease to talk about vague, and for the Far East, unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. And the less we're hampered by idealism, the better. Now, again, in words, you can't have a finer expression of the primitive logic of competitive human tribalism writ large in the most powerful state on the planet. And this has been the consistent underlying theme, I would argue, in U.S. foreign policy to the present day. If you want a scary website, go to, it's an official U.S., the New American Century website set up by the current crowd within the Bush administration. And just go to it. I won't bias your interpretation. So, you'll be glad to know that this is very close to the end. Enlightened rationality is different from enlightenment rationality. Enlightened rationality requires that we identify with other humans and with the environment, and that we consciously override what I've suggested are now maladaptive socio-behavioral tendencies. At one point, that cohesive primitive tribalism, our capacity for myth-making and all of that, our capacity to compete and appropriate more and more of the world's surface for our own use, did us good service. We were extremely successful. And it might continue to do so if this were an infinite planet extending in all directions as far as the eye could see. But it's not. We're still burdened with those behaviors. We're still burdened with the lack of inhibition toward destroying our habitats, other species, or other human beings. They will not come to us, those inhibitions, from our biology. There was no purpose to having them when we were harmless. We have become harmful. So we must shift our values consciously, a social effort on a global scale, from the narrow focus on individualism, narrow self-interest, and an emphasis on competitive relationships, toward a greater emphasis on community and societal values, cooperative institutions for international order, and a sense of participating consciousness in nature. Now, that's a hell of a charge to put to all of us. But if we don't do it, I just don't think that we're going to see that the 21st century will be any less bloody and marred by unfortunate incidents than was the 20th century. We have in our behavioral kit bag all of the qualities necessary. We can love. We are compassionate. We have empathy with other species and with other people. We can choose to emphasize those qualities of the human being in our schools, in our education system, even in our industry, in the private sector. We can elevate ourselves to being truly human because these are the unique qualities of our species, shared to no like nothing like the extent that we enjoy these qualities by other species. Oh, sure, they have responses to kin and offspring and so on, but nothing remotely like the range of human emotional capacity exists in other organisms. It's a matter of social choice whether we stress in our cultural institutions, in our education, the darker colors of the human behavioral spectrum, or whether we choose to play on the brighter colors. So I guess my charge to us all is that we have an opportunity to rise above our mere animal instincts and the origins that have served us so well, but we've now reached a real turning point in the human future. It's ours to choose. Thank you.
Many times, that's the best you've ever done. It was fantastic. Wow. Dr. East has agreed to take questions. We have a short time for questions. Would you please make your questions brief and to the point? And I'm sure that Dr. East will attempt to repeat the question so that everyone can hear it. Right here, in blue. Yes?
Yeah, so the question is, how do I see population growth in this equation? Easter Island, for example, clearly overshot its carrying capacity and collapsed down to a much reduced carrying capacity because they essentially destroyed the biological base. Human population growth is still a major problem. It's taboo to speak about. We don't talk about it because the third world countries, where most of the population growth is happening, I see it as a form of racist or other north-south oppression. They simply regard it as something we can't talk about. If you go back to the Rio conference in 93, all right, the third world refused to talk about population because the first world refused to talk about consumption. Now, in my view, both are part of the equation. The ecological footprint is a product of population times per capita consumption. But if you really want to talk about population growth as a means of reducing the ecological footprint, you start in Europe, Canada, and the United States. Because we have 10 times the impact per capita, minimally, of the average person in a developing country. Which is not to say population growth in developing countries isn't important. It's just to point out that consumption is by far the major driver of the difficulties we're in right now. 65% of world resource consumption and pollution
can be traced to rich cities in the developed countries alone. And it's consumption, not population growth, that drives the dynamic in those places. So I'm not diminishing the role of population. I'm simply saying you have to think of it in a much broader context than that and recognize that each of you is the equivalent of many, many people in the average developing country.
After the second row up the top there.
Haven't you detected my inimitable and unlimited optimism about all of it?
Well, I've been an educator all of my professional life. And one of the reasons I've chosen to do that is because of my naive belief that better informed people make better decisions. It turns out that what education does is convince people after some tragic event has happened that they, in fact, probably ought to have done better, and maybe we can do better in the future. Unfortunately, people tend to respond rather more to tragic events and disasters than they do to looming crises. Now, again, there's a good biological reason for that in many respects. Human beings are predisposed to be conservative in their social behavior because we evolved in a circumstance when there was no change in the state of the world or the economy from the beginning of your life to the end. If you can imagine, a lot of people lived to be very old, even 50,000 years ago, but they wouldn't have seen any change occur in that whole period of time. So the patterns of behavior that worked were very, almost any change would have been a negative kind of change. Today, we're facing extremely rapid change. And we're simply not equipped mentally, intellectually, or psychologically to respond to that rapid change until it hits us with some major disaster. I was hoping that... I won't tell you what I was hoping. So I hope that answers your question. So we were at a conference the other day about energy. It may be that the energy crisis or the water crisis or the current conflict in Iraq is over both, if you want to get deeply into the history. That may be the thing that crunches it. Listen, I am very optimistic in the last couple of days. The extent to which the counter-public opinion to the United States' limbic response to this problem is beginning to have an effect. So that's, frankly, the most hopeful thing that's happened. If they go to war, I'm going to commit suicide. Because if my wife just said, oh, please don't. I'm not sure what. But,
right.
Yeah, okay, next question.
Well, I teach school too, and I go to any invitation. I've never turned down an invitation to speak in any school, and I really enjoy youngsters. They're, as you say, they're. You could. Any?
Way up there at the back, halfway up the back, yes.
It's a fallacy.
You see,
when we talk about over... Whoops, am I... Oh, I'm sorry. How would I respond to the alleged overproduction of agriculture on planet Earth today? So in other words, we've mastered the problem of food production. There's too much food for
of people today. It reminds me of a claim a few years ago of the Indian government that India had become self-sufficient in food. Now, if anyone has visited rural India, you will realize that that's a rather peculiar circumstance, because there are literally tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people in India who are malnourished, as there are in many other parts of the world. India is self-sufficient in food in the same way that Great Britain is self-sufficient in Rolls Royces. Anyone who has the money to buy one can get one. And in terms of global food production, it's the same situation. There is an overproduction of food in large, rich, food-subsidized countries, but there's no surplus of food on the planet, insofar as I think the last UN number was 800 million people still are grotesquely malnourished every day on this earth. They simply can't afford to enter the global food market.
So in short, the so-called food surplus is an economic surplus in developed countries induced by, frankly, insane agricultural policies and enormous subsidies by the governments of their own agriculture. Well, we could argue about this all night. First of all, the amount of land coming out of agriculture due to water logging, salination of soils, inappropriate irrigation, soils erosion, now exceeds by a factor of 3 the amount of new land coming into production every year. So the land base is steadily shrinking. The so-called Green Revolution occurred largely because of the spread, not so much of new seed, but rather of irrigation, of fertilizers, and pesticide use, which is playing havoc with the world's agricultural systems, to say nothing of the gross decline in biodiversity that results from the destruction of traditional crops that grew quite happily prior to the so-called Green Revolution. So what we're doing with the Green Revolution is producing enormous quantities of not necessarily better food, but destroying the agricultural land base in the process, on the assumption that we can always continue to provide fertilizers, which happen to be made out of fossil fuels, which are also depleting Canada. Hey, people, have you noticed this is a cold, dark country? This year, for the first year in 20, our exports of natural gas to the United States will decline. This is not because the demand has fallen off. It's because we don't have the supply. Alberta produces 80% of Canada's natural gas. Alberta has shipped more gas than it's found every year since 1980. Alberta's production will peak this year and begin to decline at 3% per year thereafter at an accelerating rate. Most of the so-called Arctic gas that will be delivered to make up for this supply will be used to produce, guess what? Tar sands oil, because the production of oil from the tar sands is an inordinately energy-intensive process that is currently based on stranded gas. So the new pipelines, the first 7 years at least of its production,